5. Monday, August 1st. John Leandro finished talking, knocked back the rest of his beer, and asked David Wright, "So, what do you think he'll say?" Wright thought for a moment. He and Leandro were in the Bounty Tavern, a wildly over-decorated Bangor pub with only 2 real marks in its favor. It was almost directly across the street from the editorial offices of the Bangor Daily News, and on Mondays you could get Heineken for $1.25 a bottle. "I think he'll start by telling you to hurry over to Derry and finish getting the rest of the community calendar," Wright said. "Then I think he might ask you if you've thought about psychiatric help." Leandro looked absurdly crushed. He was only 24, and the last 2 stories he had covered, the disappearance, read presumed murder, of the 2 state troopers, and the suicide of a 3rd, had whetted his appetite for the high-voltage stuff. When stacked up against being in on a grim midnight hunt for the bodies of 2 state troopers, reporting on the Derry and Vets Coverdish supper wasn't much. He didn't want the heavy stuff to end. Wright felt almost sorry for the little twerp. Trouble was, that was what Leandro was. Being a twerp at 24 was acceptable. He was pretty sure, however, that Johnny Leandro was still going to be a twerp at 44, 64, at 84, if he lived that long. A twerp of 84 was a slightly awesome and wholly frightening idea. Wright decided to order another beer after all. "I was just joking," Wright said. "Then you think he will let me follow it up?" "No." "But you just said..." "I was joking about the psychiatric help part," Wright said patiently. "That's what I was joking about." He was Peter Renault, the city editor. Wright had learned a good many years ago that city editors had one thing in common with God himself, and he suspected that Johnny Leandro was about to learn it himself very soon now. Reporters might propose, but it was city editors like Peter Renault who eventually disposed.
"But you have nothing to follow up," Wright said.
If Haven's Inner Circle, those who had made the trip into Bobby Anderson's shed, could have heard what Leandro said next, his life expectancy might well have sunk to days, maybe mere hours.
"I've got Haven to follow up,"
was what he said, and quaffed the rest of his Heineken Dark in 3 long swallows.
"Everything starts there. The kid disappears in Haven, the woman dies in Haven, Rhodes and Gabbins are coming back from Haven, Dugan commits suicide. Why? Because he loved the McCausland woman," he says. "The McCausland woman from Haven."
"Don't forget lovable old Gramps," Wright said. "He's running around saying his grandson's disappearance was a conspiracy. I kept expecting him to start whispering about Fu Manchu and white slavery."
"So what is it?" Leandro asked dramatically. "What's going on in Haven?" "It is the insidious doctor,"
Wright said. His beer arrived. He no longer wanted it. He only wanted to get out of here. Bringing up lovable old Gramps had been a mistake. Thinking about lovable old Gramps made him feel a trifle uneasy. Gramps was obviously off his rocker, but there had been something about his eyes.
"What?"
"Dr. Fu Manchu. If you see Nayland Smith hanging around, I think you've got the story of the century." Wright leaned forward and whispered hoarsely,
"White slavery. Remember who you heard it from when you get the call from the New York Times."
"I don't think that's very funny, David."
"An 84-year-old twerp,"
Wright thought again.
"Imagine it."
"Or here's one," Wright said. "Little green men, the invasion of Earth is already underway, see, only no one knows it, and, ta-da, no one will believe this heroic young news hawk. Robert Redford stars as John Leandro in this nail-biting saga of..." The bartender wandered down and said, "You want to turn it down?" Leandro got up, his face stiff. He dropped 3 dollar bills on the bar. "Your sense of humor is adolescent, David."
"Or try this,"
Wright said dreamily.
"It's both Fu Manchu and green men from space, an alliance formed in hell, and no one knows but you, Johnny. Kalatu Barada Niktu."
"Well, I don't care if Renault lets me follow it up or not," Leandro said. And Wright saw that he might have twanged Johnny's strings just a little too hard. The twerp was furious. "My vacation starts next Friday. I may just go down to Haven, follow it up on my own time."
"Sure,"
Wright said, excited. He knew he should let up. Pretty soon, Leandro was probably going to try to punch him in the mouth. but the guy just kept giving him openings.
Sure, that's got to be part of it. Redford wouldn't take the part unless he could go it alone. The lone wolf. Klaatu Barada Nixu. Wow. Just remember to wear your special watch when you go down there.
What watch? Leandro asked, his face still angry. Oh, he was pissed, all right, but he kept leading with his chin just the same.
You know, the one that sends out an ultrasonic signal that only Superman can hear when you pull out the stem?
Sprite said, demonstrating with his own watch, and spilling a fair amount of beer into his crotch.
He goes, "Wee!"
I don't care what Peter Renault thinks, and I don't care how many stupid jokes you make, Leandro said. You both just might get a big surprise. He started out, then turned back. And for the record, I think you're a cynical shithead with no imagination. Having delivered this valedictory, Johnny Leandro turned on his heel and stalked grandly out. Bright lifted his glass and tipped it toward the bartender.
Let's drink to the cynical shitheads of the world, he said. We have no imagination, but we're remarkably resistant to twerpism.
Whatever you say, the bartender said. He believed he had seen it all before. But then, he had never tended bar in Haven.
6.
Tuesday, August 2nd. There were six of them who met late that afternoon in Newt Barringer's office. It was going on 5 p.m., but the clock in the tower, a tower that looked real, but which a bird could easily have flown through if there had been any birds left in Haven Village, still read 3:05. All six had spent some time in Bobby's shed. Adley McKean was the most recent addition to their number. The others included Newt, Dick Allison, Kyle, Hazel, and Frank Spruce. They discussed the few things they had to discuss without talking aloud. Frank Spruce asked how Bobby was. Still alive, Newt responded, no one knew anymore. She might come out of the shed again, more likely she would not. Either way, they would know when it happened. Discussion turned briefly to what Hank Buck had done the day before and what Hank said he'd heard coming from that other world. None of them were much concerned with the late and not-so-great Fitz Barfield. Perhaps the punishment had suited the crime. Perhaps it had been a little too extreme. It didn't matter. It was over. Nothing had happened to Hank as a result of what he had done. He had given Randy Kroger a personal check for the broken display window and the goods that had been sucked through the hole Hank had spiked into reality. Kroger called Northern National in Bangor to verify the check. He found it was good, and that was all he cared about. There was little they could have done about Hank, even if they'd had a mind to. The town's one jail cell was in the town hall's basement, a converted storeroom where Ruth had jugged a few weekend drunks, and it might hold Hank Buck for all of 10 minutes. A strong 14-year-old could have broken out of it. And they couldn't very well have sent Hank up to county jail. The charge would have looked pretty odd. The alternatives available to them were simple. Let him alone or pack him off to Altair 4. Luckily, they were able to look closely into Hank's mind and motivations. They saw that his anger and confusion were subsiding, as they were all over town. He was not apt to do anything radical again, so they took away his converted radio, asked him not to make another, and moved on to what concerned them a little more. The voice he claimed to have heard. It was David Brown, all right, Frank Spruce said now. Anybody doubt it? No one did. David Brown was on Altair 4. No one knew exactly where Altair 4 was or what it was, and they didn't much care. The words themselves came from some old movie and meant no more than the name Tommyknockers, which came from some old rhyme. What mattered, and even this didn't much, was that Altair 4 was a kind of cosmic warehouse, a place where all sorts of things were stored. Hank had sent Fitz there, but first he had put the smelly old son of a bitch through some half-assed sort of disintegration process. This had apparently not been the case with David Brown. Long, thoughtful silence.
Yes, probably yes.
This last was not ascribable to any one person. It was groupthink, hive-like, and complete in itself.
But why? Why bother?
They looked at each other with no emotion. They could feel emotion, but not over such a minor matter as this.
Bring him back, Hazel said indifferently.
It'll please Bryant and Marie. And Ruth. She would have wanted it. And we all did love her, you know. Her thought had the tone of a woman suggesting that a friend buy her son a soft drink as a treat for being good.
No, Adley said, and they all looked toward him.
It was the first time he had entered their conversation. He looked embarrassed, but pushed on anyway. Every paper and TV station in the state would be down here to get a story on the miracle return. They think he must be dead. Only four and gone over 2 weeks now. If he shows up, it'll make too much whoop to do. They were nodding now. And what would he say? Newt put in. When they asked him where he'd been, what would he say? We could blank his memories, Hazel said. That would be no problem at all, and the press people would accept amnesia as perfectly natural, under the circumstances.
Yes, but that's not the problem.
It was the many voices again, as one voice. They came together in a strange combination of words and images. The problem was that things had now gone too far to allow anyone in town except for the most transient through traveler, and even most of them could be discouraged with fake road construction and detour signs. The last people they wanted in Haven were a bunch of reporters and TV camera crews, and the clock tower wouldn't show up on film. It was a mind slide, really no more than a hallucination. No, David Brown was best left alone, all things considered. He would be all right for yet a while. They knew little about Altair 4, but they did know that time ran at a different speed there. On Altair 4, less than a year had passed since Earth had been flung out of the sun. So David Brown had in fact just gotten there. Of course, he still might die. Strange microbes might invade his system. Some strange Altair 4 warehouse rat might gobble him up. Or he might die of simple shock. But he probably wouldn't, and if he did, it really wasn't very important. I've a feeling the boy might come in handy, Kyle said.
How?
As a diversion.
What do you mean?
Kyle didn't know exactly what he meant. It was only a feeling that if a spotlight were to be trained on Haven again, the way Ruth had tried to train one on the town with her damned exploding dolls, which had worked ever so much better than they were supposed to work, perhaps they could bring David Brown back and set him down somewhere else. If that was done in the right way, they might gain a little more time here. Time was always a problem. Time to become. Kyle expressed these ideas in no coherent way, but the others nodded at the drift of his thoughts. It would be well to keep David Brown waiting in the wings, so to speak, a while longer.
Don't let Marie know. She hasn't gone far enough in the becoming. He must hide this from Marie yet a while.
All six looked around, eyes widening. That voice, weak but clear, belonged to none of them. It had come from Bobby Anderson. Bobby! Hazel cried, half rising from her seat. Bobby, are you all right? How are you doing? No answer. Bobby was gone. There was not even a feel of her left in the air. They looked at each other cautiously, testing each other's impressions of that thought, confirming that it had been Bobby. Each knew that if he or she had been alone with no confirmation available, he or she would have dismissed it as an incredibly powerful hallucination. How are we going to keep it from Marie? Dick Allison asked, almost angrily. We can't hide nothing from anybody else. Yes, Newt returned, we can. Not good enough yet, maybe, but we can dim out our thoughts a little. Make them hard to see, because...
Because we've been out there, been in the shed, Bobby's shed. We wore the headphones in Bobby's shed, and ate to become. Take ye, eat, do this in remembrance of me.
A sigh ran gently through them. We'll have to go back, Adley McKean said, won't we? Yes, Kyle said. We will. It was the only time anyone spoke aloud during the entire meeting, and it marked its end. 7. Wednesday, August 3rd. Andy Bozeman, who had been Haven's only realtor up until 3 weeks ago when he simply closed his office, had discovered that mind reading was something a fellow got used to very quickly. He didn't realize how quickly, or how much he had come to depend on it, until it was his turn to go on out to Bobby's place to help and to keep an eye on the drunk. Part of his problem, he knew it was going to be a problem after talking to Enders and the Tremaine lad, was being this close to the ship. It was like standing next to the biggest power generator in the world. Constant eddies and flows of its weird force ran over his skin like skirling sand devils in the desert. Sometimes large ideas would float dreamily into his mind, making it impossible to concentrate on what he was doing. Sometimes the exact opposite would occur, thought would break up completely, like a microwave transmission interrupted by a burst of ultraviolet rays. But most of it was just the physical fact of the ship, looming there like something out of a dream. It was exhilarating, awe-inspiring, frightening, wonderful. Bozeman thought he now understood how the Israelites must have felt carrying the Ark of the Covenant through the desert. In one of his sermons, the Reverend Gueringer said that some fellow had ventured to stick his head in there just to see what all the shouting was about, and he had dropped dead on the spot, because it had been God in there. There might be a kind of God in that ship, too, Andy thought. And even if that God had fled, it had left some residue, some of itself, and thinking about it made it hard to keep your mind on the business at hand. Then there was Gardner's unsettling blankness. You kept running into it like a closed door that should have been open. You'd yell at him to hand you something, and he would go right on with what he was doing. Just no response. Or you'd go to tune in on him, just sort of fall into the run of his thoughts, like picking up a telephone on a party line to see who was talking, and there would be no one there. No one at all, nothing but a dead line. There was a buzz from the intercom nailed to the inside wall of the lean-to. Its wire ran across the muddy, churned ground and into the trench from which the ship jutted. Bozeman flipped the toggle over to talk. "I'm here." "The charge is set," Gardner said. "Call me up." He sounded very, very tired. He had thrown himself up pretty fair country drunk last night, Bozeman thought, judging by the sound of the puking he had heard from the back porch around midnight. And when he glanced into Gardner's room this morning, he had seen blood on his pillow. "Right away." The episode with Enders had taught them all that when Gardner asked to be brought up, you didn't waste time. He went to the windlass and began to crank. It was a pain in the ass having to do this by hand, but there was a temporary shortage of batteries again. Give them another week and everything out here would be running like clockwork, except Bozeman doubted if he would be here to see it. Being near the ship was exhausting. Being near Gardner was exhausting in a different way. It was like being near a loaded gun that had a hair trigger. The way he had sucker-punched poor John Enders now, the only reason John hadn't known it was coming was because Gardner was such an infuriating blank. Every now and then a bubble of thought, partial or complete, would rise to the surface of his mind, as readable as a newspaper headline, but that was all. Maybe Enders had it coming. Bozeman knew that he wouldn't be too nuts about being stuck at the bottom of a trench with one of those explosive radios, but that wasn't the point. The point was that Johnny hadn't been able to see it coming. Gardner could do anything at any time, and no one could stop him because no one could see it coming. Andy Bozeman almost wished Bobby would die so they could get rid of him. It would be tougher with just Havenites working on the project, true, it would slow them down. But it would almost be worth it. The way he could come out of left field at you was so fucking unsettling. This morning, for instance, coffee break. Bozeman sitting on a stump eating some of those little peanut butter and cracker sandwiches and drinking iced coffee from his thermos. He'd always preferred hot coffee to cold, even in warm weather, but since he'd lost his teeth, really hot drinks seemed to bother him. Gardner had been sitting cross-legged like one of those yoga masters on a dirty swatch of tarpaulin, eating an apple and drinking a beer. Bozeman didn't see how anyone could eat an apple and drink a beer at the same time, especially in the morning, but Gardner was doing it. From here, Bozeman could see the scar an inch or so above Gardner's left eyebrow. The steel plate would be under that scar. Gardner had turned his head and caught Bozeman looking at him. Bozeman flushed, wondering if Gardner was going to start to yell and rant. If maybe he was going to come over here and try to sucker punch him the way he had Johnny Enders. If he tries that, Bozeman thought, curling his hands into fists, he's going to find that I'm no sucker. Instead, Gard had begun to speak in a clear, carrying voice. There was a small, cynical smile on his mouth as he did it. After a moment, Bozeman realized he wasn't just speaking. He was reciting. The man was sitting out here in the woods, cross-legged on a dirty tarp, hung over out of his mind, the glittering body of the ship in the earth casting moving ripples of reflection on his cheek, and reciting like a schoolboy. The man was unfucking stable, Bozeman would tell the world. He sincerely wanted Gardner dead. Tom gave up the brush with reluctance in his face, but alacrity in his heart. Gardner said, eyes half closed, face turned up toward the warm morning sun. That little smile never left his lips.
And while the late steamer, Big Missouri, worked and sweated in the sun, the retired artist sat on a barrel in the shade close by, dangled his leg, munched his apple, and planned the slaughter of more innocents. What? Andy began, but Gardner, his smile now spreading into a genuine, if nonetheless cynical, grin, overrode him. There was no lack of material. Boys happened along every little while. They came to jeer, but they remained to whitewash. By the time Ben was fagged out, Tom had traded the next chance to Billy Fisher for a kite, in good repair, and when he played out, Johnny Miller bought in for a dead rat and a string to swing it with.
Gardner drank the rest of his beer, belched and stretched.
You never brought me a dead rat and a string to swing it with, but I got an intercom bogey, and I guess that's the start, huh?
I don't know what you're talking about, Bozeman said slowly.
He had only gotten 2 years of college, business admin, before having to drop out and go to work. His father had a heart condition and chronic high blood pressure. High-flown fellows like this made him nervous and angry, lording it over ordinary folks, as if being able to quote from something written by someone who had died a long time ago made their shit smell sweeter than other people. Gardner said,
"That's okay. It's from Chapter 2 of Tom Sawyer. When Bobby was a kid back in Utica, 7th grade, they had this thing called Junior Exhibition. It was a recitation competition. She didn't want to be in it, but her sister Anne decided she ought to be, that it would be good for her or something, and when Sister Anne decided something, brother, it was decided. Anne was a real Tartar then, Bozy, and she's a real Tartar now. At least I guess she is. I haven't seen her in a long time, and that's the way, I like it. But I think it's fair to say she's still the same. People like her very rarely change."
"Don't call me Bozy," Andy said, hoping he sounded more dangerous than he felt. "I don't like it. When I had Bobby in freshman comp, she wrote once about how she froze trying to recite Tom Sawyer. I just about cracked up."
Gardner got to his feet and started walking toward Andy, a development the ex-realtor viewed with active alarm.
"I saw her after class the next day and asked her if she still remembered how whitewashing the fence went. She did. I wasn't surprised. There are some things you never forget, like when your sister or your mother bulldozed you into some horror show like Junior X. You may forget the piece when you're standing up there in front of all those people, otherwise you could recite it on your deathbed."
"Look," Andy said, "we ought to get back to work."
I let her get about 4 sentences in, then I joined her. Her jaw dropped almost down to her knees. Then she started grinning, and we went through it together, word for word. It wasn't so strange. We were both shy kids, Bobby and I. Her sister was the dragon in front of her cave. My mother was the dragon in front of mine. People like that often get this very weird idea that the way to cure a shy kid is to put him into the sort of situation he dreads the most, something like Junior X. It wasn't even much of a coincidence that we'd both gotten that whitewashing thing by heart. The only one more popular for recitation is the Telltale Heart."
Gardner drew in breath and screamed, "Stop, fiends! Dissemble no more! Tear up the floorboards! Here! Here! 'Tis the beating of his hideous heart!" Andy had uttered a small shriek. He dropped his thermos and half a cup of cold coffee stained the crotch of his pants.
"Uh-oh, Bozy," Gardner said conversationally. "Never get that out of those polyester slacks." "Only difference between the two of us was that I didn't freeze," Gardner said. "In fact, I won a second prize ribbon. But it didn't cure my fear of talking in front of crowds, only made it worse. Whenever I stand up in front of a group to read poetry, I look at all those hungry eyes. I think of whitewashing the fence. Also, I think about Bobby. Sometimes that's enough to get me through. Anyway, it made us friends."
"I don't see what any of that has to do with getting this work done," Andy cried in a hectoring voice utterly unlike him. But his heart had been beating too fast. For a moment there, when Gardner had shrieked, he really had believed the man had gone insane.
"You don't see what this has to do with whitewashing the fence?"
Gardner asked and laughed.
"Then you must be blind, Bozy."
He pointed to the ship, leaning skyward at its perfect 45-degree angle, rising out of the wide trench.
We're digging it up instead of whitewashing it, but that doesn't change the principle a bit. I have fagged out Bobby Tremaine and John Enders, and if you're back tomorrow, I'll eat your hush puppies. Thing is, I never seem to get any prizes for it. You tell whoever comes out tomorrow, I want a dead rat and a string to swing it by, Bosie, or a bully taw at the very least.
Gardner had stopped halfway to the trench. He looked around at Andy.
Andy's failure to read this big man with the sloping shoulders and the indistinct, oddly broken face had never made Bozeman more uncomfortable than it did then. Better still, Bosie, Gardner had said in a voice so soft Andy could hardly hear it. Get Bobby out here tomorrow. I'd like to find out if the new improved Bobby still remembers how to recite whitewashing the fence from Tom Sawyer.
Then, without another word, he had gone to the sling and waited for Andy to lower him down.
If that whole thing hadn't been left field, Andy didn't know what was. And, he added to himself as he turned the winch, that had only been Gardner's first beer of the day. He'll put away another 5 or 6 at lunch and really get wild and crazy.
Gardner now came swaying to the top of the trench, and Andy had an urge to let go of the windlass crank. Solve the problem. Except he couldn't. Gardner belonged to Bobby Anderson, and until Bobby either died or came out of the shed, things had to go on pretty much as they were.
Come on, Bosie. Some of those rocks lie a long way.
He started toward the lean-to. Andy fell in beside him, hurrying to keep up.
I told you I don't like you calling me Bosie, he said.
Gardner spared him a curiously flat glance.
I know, he said.
They went around the lean-to. About 3 minutes later, another of those loud, crumping roars shuddered out of the trench. A spray of rocks rose into the sky and came down, rattling off the hull of the ship with dull clangs and clong.
Well, let's... Bozeman began.
Gardner grabbed his arm. His head was tilted, his face alert, his eyes dark and lively.
Shh!
Andy wrenched his arm away.
What in the hell's wrong with you?
Don't you hear it?
I don't hear...
Then he did. A hissing sound like a giant tea kettle was coming from the trench. It was growing. A mad excitement suddenly seized Andy. There was more than a little terror in it.
It's them,
he whispered and turned toward guard. His eyes were the size of doorknobs. His lips, shiny with loose spittle, were trembling.
They weren't dead. We woke them up. They're coming out.
Jesus is coming, and is he pissed?
Gardner remarked, unimpressed. The hissing grew louder. Now there was another crunching thud. This wasn't an explosion. It was the sound of something heavy collapsing. A moment later, something else collapsed. Andy. The strength ran out of his legs, and he fell to his knees.
It's them, it's them, it's them,
he slobbered. Gardner hooked a hand into the man's armpit, wincing a little at the hot, jungly dampness there, and pulled him to his feet.
That's not the Tommyknockers, he said. It's water.
Huh?
Bozeman looked at him with dazed incomprehension.
Water!
Gardner cried, giving Bozeman a brisk little shake.
We just brought in our swimming pool, Bosie.
The hiss suddenly exploded into a soft, steady roar. Water jetted out of the trench and into the sky in a widening sheet. This was no column of water. It was as if a giant child had just pressed his finger over a giant faucet to watch the water spray everywhere. At the bottom of the trench, water was driving up through a number of fissures in just that way.
Water?
Andy asked weakly. He couldn't get it right in his mind. Gardner didn't reply. Rainbows danced in the water. It ran down the sleek hull of the ship in rivulets, leaving beads behind. And as he watched, he saw those drops begin to skitter, the way water flecked into hot fat on a griddle will skitter and hop. Only this was not random. The drops were lining up in obedience to lines of force which ran down the hull of the ship like lines of longitude on a globe.
I can see it,
Gardner thought.
I can see the force radiating from the ship's skin in those drops. My God!
There was another crunch. Gardner seemed to feel the earth actually drop a bit under his feet. At the bottom of the trench, water pressure was finishing the work the blasting had begun, widening fissures and holes, pulling the friable rock apart. More water began to escape, and more easily. The sheets of spray fell back. A last diffuse rainbow wavered in the air and disappeared. Gardner saw the ship shift as the rock weld which had prisoned it so long let go. It moved so slightly it might have been imagination, but it wasn't. In that brief movement, he could see how it would look coming out of the ground. He could see its shadow rippling slowly over the ground as it came up and out, could hear the unearthly wailing of its hull scraping over the bones of bedrock, could sense everyone in Haven looking this way as it rose into the sky hot and glittering, a monstrous silver coin slowly heeling over to the horizontal for the first time in millennia, floating soundlessly in the sky, floating free. He wanted that. God, right or wrong, he wanted that so bad. Gardner gave his head a brisk shake as if to clear it.
Come on, he said. Let's take a look.
Without waiting, Gardner walked across to the trench and looked in. He could hear rushing water, but it was hard to see. He attached one of the big cleats they used for night work to the stirrup of a sling and lowered it about 10 feet. That was plenty. If he had lowered it another 10, it would have been underwater. It had been a lake they had broken into, all right, no joke. The trench was filling rapidly. After a moment, Andy joined him. His face was wretched. All that work, he cried.
Did you bring your diving board, Bosey? Are we going to have free swim on Thursdays or for...
Shut up!
Andy Bozeman screamed at him.
Shut up! I hate you!
Wild hysteria washed over Gardner. He staggered away to a stump and sat down, wondering if the goddamn thing had stayed watertight all these years, wondering what the fair market price was for a flying saucer with water damage. He began to laugh. Even when Andy Bozeman came over and hit him upside the face and knocked him onto the ground, Jim Gardner couldn't stop laughing.